Thank you very much, Paul, for this nice introduction. Good evening, everyone. So what I'd like to do this evening is I'd like to talk about an aspect of the mobile web that perhaps is not necessarily one that you hear so much about today. We hear a lot about apps, we hear a lot about smartphone adoption and all the great things that we can do with our smartphones. In fact, that American Express card, you're probably carrying it with you today on your cell phone, and if you are not, you will very soon. And so, in effect, American Express has won through smartphones. But along the way, a number of security and privacy challenges have also emerged. And what I'd like to do today is look at where we are in this area, trying to perhaps better depict what the challenges are and point out that those challenges, as well as the solutions to some of these challenges, are not purely technical in nature. And there's both a technical and a human side to these problems. And so with this in mind, as Paul pointed out, everyone probably in this room has a smartphone today. These numbers here are some recent numbers from the United States, but the situation, as best that I've been able to establish, and I try to get up to speed on where we are in Hong Kong every year when I come and visit, as best as I've been able to establish, the Hong Kong market is very similar today to the U.S. market. It might even be slightly ahead in some regard. So when you're looking at adoption today, about 50% of all cell phone users in the United States, and perhaps a bit more here in Hong Kong, have smartphones already. But what's more interesting is when you look at the cell phones that are actually being sold today. And so in the United States today, about 70% of all the cell phones sold are actually smartphones. So what that means is that adoption is accelerating, and we're getting very, very close now to the point where very soon close to 100% of the population will actually have a smartphone. And that's obviously absolutely amazing, right? If you don't realize, smartphone adoption is growing very fast worldwide. And cell phone adoption, there's no technology that has been as broadly adopted worldwide as cell phones. So if you look at cell phones, I'm not talking about smartphones just yet, but we're going to get there. Cell phone adoption today, we're looking at 6 billion cell phone users worldwide. This is unprecedented. Right, and so along the way, we can place phone calls, but what's exciting about smartphones is we can do a lot more, right? And the question is, well, what does that mean, and what is driving all that? Well, one of the phenomena that's driving this growth is obviously the ability to download applications on these smartphones. So if you're looking today at the App Store, if you're looking today at the Android market, you find that we're looking at something like probably about 50 billion downloads just this year, right? 50 billion downloads. And that figure will continue to grow. So that figure is projected to reach perhaps something like 100 billion downloads within just a few years. Right? That means that we're looking at an economy that will in effect generate something like perhaps $12 billion per year just purely based on apps and what people refer to as in-app purchases, which is essentially the ability to make purchases from within apps. For instance, people who play games, right? Think about Farmville, right? You're potentially purchasing additional seeds to plant, right? Through the App Store, you're potentially purchasing content that you might be able to read through an e-reader through these App Stores. These are examples of App Store purchases. And obviously, that's a fraction of everything that's happening in this space. This space as itself, by itself, obviously, when we're looking at mobile data, is much, much larger than this. We're talking about, if you're looking at the mobile space overall, we're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars a year worldwide. And we're talking about a growing percentage of that, something like about 40% today, that's already corresponding to data. Right? So this is growing extremely fast. And so along the way, as users realize that now they can essentially carry out a number of activities that in the past required them to essentially be at the office or to carry a laptop with them, along the way what we're also seeing is trends in the enterprise that people tend to refer to these days as BYOD, right? Bring your own device. And bringing your own device is viewed by some as the ultimate nightmare, right? A typical CISO would tend to think of this as essentially being something that, you know, they were hoping their entire life that something like this would never happen, right? But the truth is that it's not something that people can ignore. And it's not something that's an absolute nightmare if you look at it more closely. And so I don't want to end up with a situation where I've depicted a black and white picture of this phenomenon. But what's important to understand is that, and this is an example of a recent survey that was conducted by Forrester Research, 48% of employees will buy their own devices, whether their organization approves that particular device or not, right? And so people who work in security, if they're still under the illusion that somehow they can say, we're going to set up a policy where essentially these behaviors are not accepted, right? Those people are just kidding themselves, right? This is what BYOD means today. And so you have essentially a situation where it's just too compelling for people to bring these devices. If you tell them that they cannot do corporate email from cell phones, what do? They use Gmail on their cell phone, and they use that for work. And you may have policies that say that's not allowed, but in truth, they still do it. There's been a number of incidents, including very high-profile incidents. For instance, in the United States, just a few months ago, right, there were sensitive emails from White House employees that were hacked, right? And this was actually done through phishing attacks. And those attacks had to do with the fact that these White House employees were actually discussing sensitive issues through Gmail, right? So whatever policy the White House had in place, they decided that this was not convenient enough. And as you know, convenience tend to carry the day most of the time. There's a blurring also between work life and private life. Paul was talking a few minutes ago about the fact that your cell phone knows so much about you. So an example of something that's particularly sensitive is your location, your whereabouts, right? If, for instance, you're working for a company and your competitor can find out that you're visiting a particular supplier or a particular customer, that can be extremely valuable information, not something that a company would want to disclose, right? You can say, well, I'm only going to be carrying this cell phone for my personal life, but the fact is you're carrying this phone as you go and visit that customer, right? And perhaps you're happening to take, you're taking a picture on that day and don't realize that picture will actually be geotagged, and you place it on Facebook because you think it's very neat. It just happens to be a picture in front of a monument in that city where there's only one corporation, and that corporation is, you know, for instance, a major customer or a major supplier. Well, you've given away information that's potentially very sensitive and that can potentially be exploited by your competitors. So there's this blurring between work life and private life that cannot be ignored these days. And so companies can come up with all the policies they want and they can declare that all these things are forbidden, but the fact of the matter is that they're going to be swamped. They're going to be taken over. And ultimately, the smarter people in this space are saying, if you can find them, fight them, then join them, right? That's the motto. Don't try, you know, the impossible. Instead, join them, but try to join them under your own terms. So what do people do? Well, the CISOs that are more forward-looking these days are actually allowing people to bring their own devices. But they're forcing people to, for instance, abide by certain policies that might be imposed on them through, for instance, mobile device management, MDM, where, for instance, you profile these devices if employees want to have access to corporate email, and they do want to have access to corporate email, if they want to have access to certain types of applications from their cell phone, you say, sure, go ahead and do it. And by the way, here's how you do it. And you profile these smartphones so that they no longer have to use they're forced to use, for instance, eight-digit PINs or complete passwords. They're forced to abide by a number of different constraints that will effectively make these environments somewhat more secure. You also have, for instance, efforts to move towards virtualized phones where you've got partitions on your phone, a partition for the company, a partition for personal life. All these approaches are great, but they also have their limitations. right? Again, because of the blurring between personal life and corporate life, right? So, for instance, that example that I just gave you about location, right? I can have a partition on my smartphone that will be restricted to corporate apps, right? But if that smartphone is also used to take pictures that are going to be geotagged and posted on Facebook and that I consider to be personal pictures, I'm actually still giving away that information, right? If I still use Gmail, right, even if I have two different cell phone numbers on my phone, and you have phones that allow you to have that today, right, if the part of my phone that's personal gets hacked because I've downloaded a malicious app in that partition, and my phone conversation with my wife where I tell her where I am happens to be eavesdropped on because I've downloaded that app, then everything falls apart too, right? And so what that means is that, you know, despite all these technologies that are obviously very useful, there are still lots of challenges. And one of the challenges in particular has to do with the fact that when people are looking at their smartphones, on the one hand, they're all excited about all the things that they can do, and they download more and more apps on these smartphones, and they try to impress their friends with everything that they can do on these smartphones. When you tell them about security, somehow, they still tend to think of their smartphones as being very innocuous types of devices. There is very little realization today about all the different vulnerabilities that are effectively associated with smartphones. The truth is that your smartphone is a much more sensitive device than your computer. Why? Well, you don't go everywhere with your computer, I hope for you, right? But you carry your cell phone wherever you go. You carry your smartphone wherever you go. And that smartphone is used for things like phone calls. You may use Skype occasionally to place calls, but you're placing phone calls through a smartphone. That means that there is very sensitive functionality that could potentially enable someone to eavesdrop on your conversations, right? You've got APIs today that make it possible to access phone functionality. In fact, that has been present for a long time on these cell phones. You can track someone's location, right? Bluetooth, right? People keep Bluetooth on, and before you know it, they're opening the doors to a number of different attacks. Wi-Fi snooping, email, and obviously all these apps, right? And so one of the challenges we face with in these environments is the fact that, in fact, the vulnerabilities have a lot to do with users not fully appreciating how sensitive these devices are. Let me perhaps illustrate this. Let's do actually a quick show of hands. I did the same show of hands actually at Hong Kong U yesterday, so we'll see how you compare with the students. So how many of you have PIN numbers on their cell phones? Okay. And just to make sure that everybody's awake, how many of you don't have PIN numbers on your cell phone? All right. Okay. Do me a favor. At the end of this presentation, please set up the PIN on your phone. Why? Well, because as it turns out, the most common vulnerability, as Paul pointed out, I'm surprised you don't have a PIN because you obviously know this.
I'm lazy.
But as Paul pointed out, cell phones get lost and they get stolen, right? And you have all this functionality on these cell phones, including SMS, including email, including probably access to your Facebook account, access to your contact list, all these things. Someone who gets your cell phone and it's not protected by a PIN will have effectively access to all your email, including potentially your corporate email, will be able to impersonate you. They've got your contact list, right? They can pretend to be you, using a phone call, or if they are afraid that somehow you're going to tell, well, that doesn't sound exactly like Paul, you could send them an SMS pretending to be Paul, and that will completely fool them, right? You can use Facebook to, spread various types of rumors. Like if you're an employee working for company X, you can say, whatever you want about company X, right? Obviously, you're not going to do that yourself, but if you've stolen the phone of someone who works for that company, you can impersonate them, spread false rumors, right? Those are the kinds of things that we're talking about. So let's actually look more closely at malicious apps in particular, right? And this is just one example. As I said, there are many more vulnerabilities. It's not just the apps. There's a lot more. Email, SMS, all these things are actually very sensitive. So one of the interesting things about this app economy, as people refer to it, is that it has grown and continues to grow by attracting developers, right? So the proposition is, here's this great environment. You know, we've got hundreds of millions of smartphone users out there, and they're all ready to buy your app. Come to this ecosystem, start building apps, and you will become rich. And come to my ecosystem, that's at least, you know, certainly what Android will tell you. Come to my ecosystem, because within my ecosystem, there are many more APIs than you will find elsewhere. And therefore, you're going to be able to build much fancier applications. You'll be able to do things that you would never be able to do in the other ecosystem. Right? So part of the competition, and everybody is actually going in that direction. I'm mentioning Android, but Apple has actually been trending in the same direction. Apple, as you know, tends to be a little more conservative than Android and Google, but they certainly understand the name of the game. They understand that it's all about providing all these APIs to developers. And the trend is about cramming more sensors in these cell phones, making more APIs available to developers, and that trend will continue. It's driven in part by the fact that cell phones are becoming fancier. You've got more sensors in them. We're also able, moving forward, to actually use these sensors to recognize things such as various elements of the context of the user beyond just the user's location. We can recognize the activities that users engage in using accelerometers, for instance. You can determine whether someone is walking, running, sitting. You can even determine with very high accuracy whether a cell phone is in someone's shirt pocket or in a purse. You can actually tell these things today. So moving forward, we're going to get APIs for these types of things as well, and more. Right? You have today APIs. You don't have today APIs, but you have technology that has been demonstrated that can be used to determine how many hours you sleep. I could have tomorrow an API that will indicate how tired you probably are. Right? This is not far-fetched. This is all happening as we speak. Right? And so this trend means that essentially, there are more and more ways in which you might be able to sense sensitive information about users and potentially exploit that for purely malicious purposes or potentially just simply to abuse the user's privacy. Right. So in particular, one of the trends over the past 2 years has been the emergence of these malicious apps. Right. So these are apps that come in many different shapes and forms. They've come in the form of, for instance, fake mobile banking applications, right? So people have posted apps that claim to be mobile banking apps for your favorite bank. And people have downloaded these apps and they've provided their credentials. And then they went to visit their bank account and they were surprised to see that somehow there was less money than the day before, right? People have a number of mundane-looking apps that somehow, you know, are going to be looking for a lot of very sensitive information, not just your location, but also your contacts list and other types of things that clearly you don't necessarily want to give away to some random company. So those numbers have gone up, as it turns out. And obviously, companies are very concerned about that, and so are consumers. And so one of the things, so here's an example. This happened, this was reported in January of this year. Massive Android malware app may have infected as many as 5 million users. There was actually a range. The number was somewhere between 1 and 5 million. Obviously, if you're a journalist, you're going to try to emphasize the 5 million. But 1 million is actually pretty large if you think about this. Right. This is what we're talking about. You're talking about people who just do not appreciate the risks involved in downloading apps on their smartphones. Right. And so what is industry doing about this? Well, Apple has actually tried to be a bit more conservative in this space. They've restricted the APIs they make available to developers a lot more than Android. I can give you examples if we have time, but I'm just not going to dwell on that for too long. They're also reviewing apps, right? A lot of people used to complain about this. They used to say, oh, it takes forever for Apple to actually approve my app. Apple has actually improved quite a bit. The process has been significantly improved in terms of time. It's less than a week these days. It tends to be a few days, as it turns out. And part of this has to do with the fact that I believe they've automated part of this process. Android, for a long time, as you know, has built its reputation on its openness, right? That has been essentially one of the main differentiating factors. And openness until not too long ago, also meant that Android gives you more APIs. It says we're not going to constrain too much the sandbox within which you operate. We're not even going to try and vet applications. We want to make it as easy as possible. I'm just quoting here, or at least paraphrasing what they've said. They've said we want to make it as easy as possible for a small guy to be able to develop and post his app as quickly as possible. We don't want to interfere. Anyone who's got something that they believe could be useful to users, go ahead and post it. The Android Marketplace welcomes you. And if users like it, they'll go ahead and download it. If they don't like it, or perhaps if they're concerned about perhaps what this app does, presumably they will not download it, and everything is fine. So this is the model of let a thousand flowers bloom, right? We're not going to be too restrictive. This was the case until about February of this year. In February of this year, Google came back and said, we're now scanning all the apps that are being posted on the App Store. So there's a program called Bouncer, as it turns out, that scans apps for malware. Right? So every time you submit an app, it's being scanned. But the truth is that because Android is so open, there's more than one Android marketplace. Right? It's called Google Play today. There are many more Android stores out there. Apple, there's only one store. Right? Android, you've got tons of other stores. You may know, for instance, of Amazon. Right? Amazon has an Android store. Right? Cell phone operators have stores. Like in the United States, Verizon has its own Android store. So I'm sure that here in Hong Kong, you also have cell phone operators that have their Android store. And these Android stores are not as sophisticated as Google is. They don't run a program like Bouncer, for instance. So in any case, how good is Bouncer? Right? So is there, you know, such a thing as a program that will catch all the malicious code out there? If such a program could be built, right, would be obviously in much, much better shape. The truth is that anyone who knows software a little bit understands that there's no way you can check software and provide any sort of strong, absolute guarantees, right? And therefore, it's no surprising that just a few days ago, about a week ago, right, this article was just published, and people just made a point. As always, security researchers like to become famous by showing that something that industry has come up with doesn't quite work as advertised. So they just showed that they were able to get past the scanning that was being done by Google. Just a demonstration of what I said earlier. So all these technologies are great, and clearly they're going in the right direction. But they also come with great limitations. And that's a key point that I want to make. I'm not saying forget about technology, it's not going to get you anywhere. Use whatever technology you can, absolutely. But don't get under the illusion that somehow this solves all your problems, because it doesn't. And along with that, you have essentially the other problems. You have the human element. So how do these other app stores actually get applications that get infected? So one of the recent trends, by the way, is that the Android marketplace seems to become a little bit more secure. According to Google, at least, they've claimed that there's been a reduction of about 40% in malware on their Android market, or Google Play, as it's called, over the past so many months. That trend seems to be encouraging. But what this really means is that the bad guys, security, as you know, is an arms race, right? And so it's all about essentially raising the bar for the bad guys. You raise the bar for the bad guys on the official Android marketplace, what happens? Well, they go to one of the other Android stores where it's a bit easier. So an example of an attack that has been very common recently is depicted here. Essentially, you've got a legitimate developer who posts an app somewhere on an Android marketplace. Then you've got a bad guy who retrieves that app along with the source code and repurposes this app by just adding a little bit of malware in it. And then they go and post it under a different name, obviously, on another Android marketplace. And that app gets downloaded by people. It looks like it's doing great things, like the original legitimate app, but it's doing a bit more, right? And people download that and they get infected. This is how these things happen. Okay, so we've tried to understand how people effectively respond to this environment. And one of the things that we did almost about a year ago now is we conducted a study of Android users intended to better appreciate how they interacted for instance, with these stores, these Android marketplace in particular. And here's what we found. So we looked essentially at, and this is an example of the Amazon Android marketplace, the Amazon App Store, and this is just a depiction of how Android deals with security. So as you probably know, or perhaps you don't know, depending on whether or not you've got an Android phone, the way Android deals primarily with security when it comes to apps is it requires developers to declare the permissions that they need for their app to properly operate. So for instance, a location-based app will require obtaining permission from the user to access that user's location, right? If that application that you're trying to download needs to have access to your contacts list, it's also going to request access to that contacts list. If it requires access to the network, it's going to request permission for that. If it requires access to your memory, it's going to request that too. And in fact, on Android today, you have something like over 130 permissions. Right? And you have applications that require quite a few of them, as you can imagine. And so here's the kind of interface that you have. For instance, in the case of the Amazon App Store, if you download an app, in this case, this is the example of where you download the Kindle app for Android phones, it's going to tell you that this app here requires your network communication, phone calls, and storage. And then you might say, well, show me a bit more, and then it shows you a screen that looks like this. This is a real screen, right? Don't ask me, don't tell me that you don't understand what I'm showing you. The whole point is that I don't understand it either when I look at this, right? So you click on more, and this is what you see. So now you're seeing storage, modify, delete SD card contents, network communication, full internet access, phone calls, etc. Let's say that you want to know more. You click on show more. What do you see? Storage, network communication, phone calls. Oh, and also network communication. But in this case, network communication means view network state, view Wi-Fi state. Okay. How many of you feel that they understand what I've read? I didn't think so. Okay. All right. So, but this is it. This is what, until a few months ago, when there was not even a program to scan applications, this was all Android offered to users. Essentially, users had to make security and privacy decisions based on that information. Right. And so this was intended to essentially empower users to be in charge of their security and privacy. This is openness at its best, right? It's the idea that, you know, we're not going to interfere. Let the users decide for themselves. The users are smart enough to be able to make the right decisions. So here's what happens and what you find out when you talk to Android users, typical Android users. Well, first of all, they do not understand Android permissions, and that's no surprise. We just checked that. The terms are clearly very vague. They're very confusing. They're misleading. They're full of jargon, right? Network communication. What do people mean by that? Now, we were surprised to see that most people actually tried to actually read these permissions when they were downloading the apps. This was a big surprise. We thought that somehow people had actually given up on that. People actually try. But the point is they do not understand, even though they're trying, right? And so how do people go about making decisions then if they don't understand what they're reading? Well, primarily based on word of mouth. That means my friend has downloaded this app and claims that this is a great app. I'm going to go ahead and imitate my friend. Ratings by other users who understand just about as much as they do. And the Android market reviews, right? So random people writing random things about apps that they do not understand better than you do, right? So people, and this is what was most interesting, and we discussed this with Google after our study, and we like to believe that this actually had an impact on the Bouncer program actually becoming available and active in February this year. So people were, by and large, under the impression, obviously false impression, that somehow Google was looking out for them. Most people thought that all these apps that they could download had been vetted by Google. They had no idea of what Google really meant by openness. They thought that somehow these permissions were there for them to decide, you know, whether or not this was consistent with perhaps their preferences. They had no idea that somehow they were supposed to evaluate these applications for security risk. That was just beyond, and that's fair, right? Who in his right mind would think that somehow a lay user would be able to make a security decision about whether or not an app is malicious just based on reading those permissions that I showed you earlier. So surely when they looked at these permissions, they said, I do not understand this. Surely Android doesn't expect me to make such a decision. Surely this must be safe. Surely Android has already vetted these apps in the first place. Okay, so, well, what are we up against just based on this? Well, we're up against, to just sort of summarize what I've tried to outline over the past few minutes, we're up against an environment where we're dealing with devices that are actually much more sensitive than regular computers and laptops. And as I think we all realize, the situation with computers and laptops is not very good, right? That's an understatement. So with cell phones, we're looking at something that's potentially even worse. And we're looking at users who clearly do not appreciate the risks. On laptops and computers these days, people understand, by and large, that there are risks involved in using computers. A lot of people have actually some kind of antivirus software, right, running on their computers. Many of them don't have up-to-date software. Many of them don't necessarily patch their software the way they should. But most people understand that they've got to have something like that. People are ill-prepared to make the right decisions. If you don't understand the risks, right, if you're working under models that are just not really going to correspond to how things really work, you're going to be in trouble. And there are a variety of bad habits and cognitive biases that people have already developed. For instance, when people download Android apps on their smartphones, right, the permissions that I showed you get shown at a point where they've already made up their mind. They've already decided that they were going to go ahead and download these apps. And they never change their mind. It's very, very unusual to find someone who will tell you that as they looked at these permissions, they said, oh my goodness, this is what this app is going to be doing. I'm changing my mind. I'm stopping the download. Very, very unusual. Essentially, these cognitive biases are very common. They don't apply just to smartphone usage. They apply across lots of different scenarios. We tend to, when we decide that we want to download an app, we basically have decided that this is something that we really want to have on our phone. And we can see the short-term rewards associated with having these smart apps, these apps on our smartphones. And the risks seem to be very vague. They seem to be long-term. They're very hard to evaluate. And we tend to heavily discount them. That's how our brains work. So, and the interface, obviously, very confusing. So what have we done in this space? We're obviously doing work on the technical side of these things, but I thought that this evening I would spend a bit more time talking about the human side of this problem and show you the kinds of things that can also be done in that area. And so in particular, one of the things that we've been doing over the past few years, we've been building software to train people to actually adopt safer practices. We've been doing that through techniques that are very different from what you might have seen before. And then we've also been building on technologies to help users make better decisions for security and for privacy. And so I'm going to illustrate a few of these things to just give you a better sense for the kind of work that we've been doing in that space. So talking about the training side of things, so bring your own device essentially implies in a way that users are going to be responsible, right? The idea is that, hey, I'm a big person, right? I can make decisions on my own. And obviously, I will not do anything crazy, anything that's going to endanger the organization. That's clearly the assumption behind bring your own device. It obviously assumes that in order for someone to be responsible, they've got to be knowledgeable. So they've got to understand the risks. They've got to understand the consequences of their actions. They've got to be accountable, right? So if they do something they're not supposed to, there's got to be a price. They've got to be able to explain why they did what they did. Now, most of you are looking at me thinking that I'm going completely crazy, right? And you're absolutely right. Hopefully you're not. But so is this truly possible, is what you're asking yourself, right? Can we really expect employees in organization to actually be responsible, knowledgeable, and accountable, right? Especially when it comes to using smartphones. Is this truly possible? And so my answer to you is, well, do you really have a choice, given the statistics that I showed you, given the fact that smartphone users will bring their smartphone in any case, whether the corporation likes it or not, right? And so there's no choice. You actually need to train these users. You have no choice. They're not going to train themselves on their own. They clearly don't do that. So somehow the organization has to do something about this. I'm not saying that's easy, but you've got to do something. You cannot just throw up your hands and say, I give up, right? Organizations cannot do that. Now, the problem, obviously, with cybersecurity training is that it's not been very successful in the past, and that's why you're looking at me thinking that, you know, I'm just going completely crazy, because most of us have this experience that somehow you cannot train people to adopt safer security practices. People have tried for many years, right? They've been herding employees in rooms and lecturing them for an hour or two at a time. And what do people do? They look for excuses to not show up. They will be reading their email during the lecture. Some of them might be catching up on sleep, if they're sleep deprived. You know, anything that they can, right, except listening. And even those who do listen in practice, whatever they've listened to, they will not apply in practice later on, because there is this big disconnect between what they heard in the lecture and what happens in practice. In the lecture, it all makes sense. You've got this perfect situation where here's the risk, here's what you should do. It all makes sense. In practice, there are lots of other things happening at the same time, right? So security, as we all know, is a secondary task, right? When you're working in your company, you've not been hired because of your security skills, unless you're a security person. You've been hired because you're a good salesperson, a good engineer, a good developer, what have you. This is your primary task. And security is a secondary task. So in practice, at any point in time, your priorities are skewed towards you doing a good job, right? As an engineer, as a software developer, as a salesperson, a marketing person, CEO, what have you. You're not typically being evaluated on how secure you are, right? And so all these things that you've learned, even if you've been paying attention, you're not very likely to apply. Traditional methods, as we've said, have not been very effective. They've not been very compelling. System administrators sending email to all the employees saying, do not do X, right? That goes straight to the junk box, or not the junk box, but that goes straight to, right, to the trash. Nobody reads these things, right? It's like, increasingly people tend to think that those are phishing emails, right? So required knowledge is also vast, right? So the problem with cybersecurity is that we're talking about a complex system of systems, and the same is true for smartphones. We're talking about layers upon layers of technologies, right? We're talking about apps that are being developed, that are accessing functionality that people poorly understand. We're talking about very complex sets of scenarios here. There's more and more that you need to teach people. And so practical strategies are also not very easy to articulate. Some of you have Android phones, some of you have iPhones, some of you have BlackBerry phones perhaps still. Some of you may have Windows phones, right? The truth is that all these different phones work a bit differently. They've got different interfaces. Coming up with good strategies for one phone model is not necessarily going to mean that that strategy is going to straightfully apply to the other model. So it's also very challenging. So these are some problems that we are up against. And so often when people talk about cybersecurity training, you often, you know, see this being compared to trying to nail Jell-O on a wall, right? Have you ever tried to nail Jell-O on a wall? I don't know if it's a common activity here in Hong Kong, but you know, somehow in the United States that, you know, evokes a picture of that's not terribly likely to work. And as you can see here, clearly these people tried, right? So they tried very hard, but somehow they've not been very successful. So what does it take to do effective cybersecurity training, especially in the smartphone space? Well, the first thing you have to do is you have to get the user on your side, as it turns out. You've got to show the user that there are some real risks, right? If the user doesn't believe that there are risks, if the user is not aware of all the risks associated with smartphones, it's going to be very challenging to train that user to get that user to pay attention to anything. So how do you get users to see that they're vulnerable, right? Well, the way we've shown you can motivate people is to actually do this via mock attacks. Launch attacks, fake attacks, hopefully, on users, right? And show them that bad things could happen to them. You don't do this in a classroom by lecturing people. How do you do this? Well, you subject people to things that could very well happen through, you know, their regular routine at work or through various activities that they engage in at work or at home, and you show them the kinds of things that could happen without harming them, hopefully. But by doing so, you prime them for training. You get them to want to know more. You get them to realize that if they're not paying attention to what you have to tell them, this thing could happen for real. So let me give you an example of the kinds of things that we've done in this space. So I'll give an example that I actually discussed a few years ago here, but that example today is actually one that has been used by hundreds of thousands of people worldwide. So we've actually commercialized these technologies. And it's very relevant to the mobile space because, in particular, one of the problems that you have on smartphones is the likelihood of users falling for phishing attacks is actually about three times higher than it is when you get email on your desktop, on your laptop. So that's an example of one of those vulnerabilities that people are actually not very well prepared to cope with. And so how do you get people to pay attention to training about phishing attacks on smartphones? Well, what you can do is you can send them fake phishing emails, right, on their smartphones. And then if they fall for these fake phishing emails, instead of stealing their credentials, you tell them, hey, this could have been real. Here's what could have happened. And here's how you could go about protecting yourself better. Right? And so one of the things we've done in that space is to essentially create what we refer to as teachable moments. And there are lots of different kinds of teachable moments that you can create. This is just one example through these phishing emails. There are lots of other things you can do. And you can actually automate these things. Right, so it's not like you need to actually type by hand, you know, and pick employee X and then pick employee Y. There are actually tools that you can develop that will enable you to do this on a massive scale, right, with all your employees, and that could even enable you to customize over time the kinds of attacks that you're going to launch at different employees based, for instance, on the kinds of activities that they engage in, based on their knowledge, based on how well they responded to earlier fake attacks. Right. So here's a typical tool that we've been using with companies. This is a tool that enables you to actually craft fake attacks. So you have this is a software as a service tool, and you compose an email, and you upload a list of employees that you want to send this email to, and it can be customized. So the first name is going to be populated by the first name that you have in your database for that employee, and you put this together in about a few minutes, as it turns out. So this works very nicely. And then you launch the attack, right? And essentially, you pick also some training. So what happens is when people are going to click on the link in the fake phishing email, that link will actually pop up some training and tell people, here's what could have happened. And here's how you could have seen, you know, that this was actually a fake email. This was a phishing email. Here's how you can protect yourself in the future. This is extremely effective. The number of people, so to give you a sense, we've done this now with lots of corporations. The number of people who typically take training when you don't prime them with something like that is below 10%. When you use this sort of attack, the people who actually see the training is above 90%. It's about 95%. That's the kind of difference that we're talking about. People will remember this. And not only they will remember that, but they will be able to apply it later on. So this is how these things look on a cell phone. Now, these tools these days, so companies very much care also about tracking the performance of their employees in response to different kinds of attacks. So they want to know who's fallen for what, how many times they've fallen. There are actually companies that will fire people if they fail, right? If you're looking at employees in particular government organizations, failing these things repeatedly can be pretty bad news. Right. Most companies are not that drastic. They just want to know how vulnerable they are, and they want to be able to then further customize their training so that perhaps those people who've fallen for this attack, they're going to send them a follow-up attack 2 weeks later. Those who didn't, perhaps they're going to leave them alone with a phishing attack, and they're going to do something else a month later. Those are the kinds of things that we're talking about. So beyond that, so how effective is this? This really works. So these are actually real numbers. I cannot disclose which organization we've done this with, but this is very typical. We've done this with lots of organizations. So this is the first campaign that you launch on your employees. Typical numbers, believe it or not, companies are really surprised when you do this. About 35 to 40% of people who receive these phishing emails actually fall for them the first time. But you do this two or three times and you get below 10%. Now, this is not 0%, but that's a lot better than 35 to 40%. Right? So those are the kinds of things that you can do to essentially prime people for training. Now, when it comes to smartphone, when it comes to smartphone security, as I pointed out, there are just tons of vulnerabilities. The bar is very high, and it's a very complex space. There are just so many things that people do wrong. You know, from even phone conversations that people have in the subway, talking about sensitive business information. You need to train people about that too, right? The number of things that people do wrong is just unbelievable. But so to give you the illusion that somehow you can train people perfectly across all these scenarios, I don't want to do that. But what I want to say is that beyond the technologies that are available today, you cannot ignore the human element. You have to look at combining technologies, policies, and also human training if you want to make progress in this space. So where do you start? Well, you start with the most basic types of threats. In fact, you start with those PIN numbers that you know, that half of the people in this room don't seem to have on their smartphones. And you get people to understand that their cell phones can be stolen and that bad things can happen, right? And as you do that, then you can incrementally get, you know, towards more sophisticated types of scenarios. So you teach people about SMS messages, which can also be used for phishing attacks, right? So congratulations, you want a free phone. I received a few of those since I've arrived in Hong Kong. In fact, I believe I receive one pretty much every day here. I don't know if it's through PCCW or some other cell phone operator, but they seem to like me, right? So maybe they're trying to train me. I'm not sure. So teach people to better appreciate the risks. But don't do this in the classroom, right? Do this through simulations. Do this, you know, through exercises that essentially replicate the context where these attacks might be launched, because that will increase so much the likelihood that people will actually apply this knowledge in practice. Teaching things in a vacuum in the classroom just doesn't work. Teaching it in context gets people to somehow organize their brain to recognize these situations, and it makes them much more likely to apply that knowledge, force them to make decisions. So all these are actually fundamental learning science principles. It's about learning by doing, right? This is how this is referred to, right? And as you start doing that, provide feedback to people when they make mistakes. Teach them, you know, to recognize different situations. Is this low risk? Is this high risk? Right? So here's this guy here, right? And he's in a given situation. He's talking on the phone, right? Is this a smart thing to do or not? There are tons of examples. Bluetooth, you know, SMS, location, posting pictures on Facebook that are geotagged. All these things are things that people have to learn about. So it's very complex. And you've got to start small and then over time move towards more complex types of scenarios. So eventually you deal with location, you deal with social networking. A lot of social networking these days is mediated by cell phones, as you know. And then move on to apps if you can. So what do we do with apps? Well, it's again learning by doing, feedback, opportunities for reflection. So what do we do? Well, we've created games where we start with very simple things. So the kinds of tips you can teach people include things such as, well, if this app has only been around for 1 week, be careful. Let a few other people download this app first and see what happens. Right? If it's been there for 3 months, there's a better chance that it's safe. Right? It's very basic things. Right? You've got to start small. Is it safe to download this app? Well, this one has been downloaded by 1,000 people, this one by 100,000 people. Which one is safer? There's no guarantee, but these are the kinds of tips that you can start with. Teach them then over time that, hey, maybe you want to do a quick Google search on this app. Right? So would you say that if the Google search returns mBank app malware warning, that's one that you want to download? Probably not. I would say this one might be a bit safer. Right? So those are examples of things that you can do. And so we've actually created games where people can start, configuring apps. So you give them a challenge. You tell them, download 3 apps, for instance, from this app store, right? And teach them essentially what to look for and give them points based on whether or not they've downloaded safe apps or malicious apps, right? And so as you do that, they really get to practice in a context that's very realistic, right? So this is an example where they've got a bunch of different apps, and, you know, all these apps have their descriptions, they've got ratings and those kinds of things, and then you tell them, if they pick an app that's malicious, you tell them, well, this is an app that's dangerous, this is why it's dangerous. And if they pick an app that's fine, then you explain to them, you know, why it's fine, or you tell them what are the kinds of things that they want to look for. So those are the kinds of things that you need to do. And with this approach, as it turns out, it's all about trying to essentially move the training into someone's daily routine. Trying to bring people in a classroom and lecturing them, no way. Trying to get people to spend an hour doing cybersecurity training doesn't work. So we developed these technologies at Carnegie Mellon originally. They've been commercialized since then. But what's interesting is to see how companies actually use these technologies these days. So for instance, when they move to bring your own device and they start essentially getting users to configure their cell phones using MDM, one of the first things that they do is they tie this to training. So they're going to say, you want to start using your phone to access corporate email and to download, to access these apps? Well, you're going to have to first complete, you know, 5 minutes of training on this. We're going to subject you to two simulations. We're going to do this. Once you've passed that, then you're good to go. And then perhaps every other week, we're going to train you on something else. And the training typically is about 5 minutes in length, because that's about as much time as people are willing to devote to these things. It's about the time it takes to eat a sandwich, or, you know, or whatever it is that you're eating over lunch. But that's essentially what you can do. Now, the other line of work that we've been looking at is how can you empower users to make better informed decisions, right? Well, one of the challenges, as I pointed out, when you look at these Android permissions, is that they're absolutely impossible to understand, and there are just way too many of them, and the trend is for more of these permissions to become available over time to developers. And so we've been asking ourselves, can we somehow help users make decisions? And the thinking is that, so these are actually examples of top 100 apps on the Android marketplace. So Facebook, at least when we did this, was number one. Brightest Flashlight is number 32. Does anyone know this app, Brightest Flashlight? Any idea what this does? You know it?
I don't know.
That's right. That's the brightest flashlight. This is the silliest possible app that you can think of. It turns your cell phone into a flashlight, and it essentially turns everything on. So you have actually the flash on your phone. You've got the screen. You potentially have also the keypad in some phones that you can illuminate. And so it turns everything on and puts it on the brightest possible setting. That's what it does. But it does a few more things, as it turns out, including it requests your location, for instance. It requests access, I think, to your contacts list and all sorts of other things. And so this is the kind of thing that users would probably want to catch, right? Those are the kinds of things that they would probably want to catch. The problem is that if you have 120 permissions or even a fraction of those 120 permissions, chances are that users will not see this, right? And they will not know what to do with these Android permissions as they're being described today in the App Store. And so what we've tried to see is to what extent we might be able to simplify these decisions for users. And so that's a paper that we're going to be presenting in September, actually, at the Ubicom conference. So as I said, this is the kinds of things that you're going to see typically when you download an app, right? And most people, as we know, do not really understand this. So how can users be expected to make sense out of this? Can we simplify the decision process? And the key insight is the following. The idea is that maybe we can leverage the wisdom of crowds to actually simplify this process. In particular, our idea was the following. Most people probably feel comfortable with tons of things that these apps require, especially if these permissions seem reasonable and they seem in line with what the app is supposed to do, right? But if an app like Brightest Flashlight requires your location, that would be something that somehow you would want to flag. It doesn't matter if this app requires 20 different permissions, your location would be the one that I would clearly want to flag. And I would ask you whether you feel comfortable about that or not, right? I would not clearly having access, for instance, to the brightness setting on your phone for this flashlight application, that would not be something that you should be terribly upset about, right? That's probably not something that you want to highlight. But location is something that I would want to highlight. Can we somehow use the wisdom of crowd to essentially help identify these types of things? And can we do that cost effectively? And so we conducted an experiment with on Amazon Turk, where we recruited 179 people. And we organized them in two different conditions. And we asked them to essentially rate the top 100 most popular apps in Android. We asked them to look at the permissions that these apps were requesting, focusing on a subset of these permissions. In particular, we looked at location, both detailed location with GPS and network location, which, as you probably know, is basically based on your IP address. So it's or GSM cell tower triangulation. A unique ID, which is essentially a super cookie that's associated with your phone. Contacts list, which is the list of people you've got in your contacts list. And we basically recruited these people. We asked them each, so each individual here was requested to answer questions about 20 different apps and permissions, and we paid them on that basis. So these are the kinds of questionnaires that were given. So in this particular case here, you're looking at another silly app that's called Toss It, right? And it's about essentially tossing a piece of paper in a garbage can, right? And so these apps, as it turns out, seem to somehow believe that they need a lot of information about you. There are many of them, right? And so we organized our participants into two groups. In one group, participants had to basically indicate whether or not they would have expected this app to require a particular permission, such as, for instance, your location. And we also asked them how comfortable they were giving that app access to this particular permission. And the other group, we told people why the app was actually requesting a particular piece of information. How did we do that? Well, there is software that we've developed that actually enables you to analyze apps at a fairly detailed level. I'm not going to go into that. And that allows you to actually find out how this piece of information is actually being used in the software. So you can actually tell, for instance, whether the location is being used for advertising or whether it's used for a different purpose. And so we've told people in this condition, in this group, that this is what happens to your location. And we asked them to indicate whether or not they were comfortable with the use of that information for that particular purpose. And here are the kinds of results that you get when you do this. So one of the things that we noticed is that there is a strong correlation between the extent to which people expect an app to use a particular resource, such as your location, and their level of comfort. Not terribly surprising, but it's nice to confirm that. So, in fact, correlation is essentially 0.91. As you probably know, complete correlation is a 1. So this is pretty strong, right? So we also measured level of comfort, as I said, which is essentially something that we measured between -2 and +2. So -2 meant very uncomfortable, and +2 meant very comfortable. So brightest flashlight, right, about 5% of the people expected it to require their network location. And not surprisingly, you know, their level of comfort was -1.25, right? So the same thing is true for the fact that it also required their GPS location and device ID. So those are obviously what I've represented here on this table is obviously just a tiny subset of all the different apps and the different resources that we looked at. But these are actually the ones where people were the most surprised. And as you can see, when people are surprised, they're also not very comfortable sharing this information, right? So the kinds of comments, we also collected free text comments from these people. So here is, for instance, one subject here, W27. Why does a flashlight need to know my location? I love this app, but now I know it accesses my location. I may delete it. Or this other one here about Toss It. I do not feel that game should ever need access to your location. I will never download this game. Right, so people obviously reacted very strongly, and some of these people actually used and downloaded these apps in the past. So what's also very interesting is to see to what extent, if you don't give people information about what an app does with a resource like your location, whether they can guess what the app does with that resource. And the answer, without going into details here, is people can't, right? People cannot guess. If you ask people to guess, you know, why does, you know, this application, Toss It, for instance, require your location? They can't figure why. They scratch their head. And because they can't figure why, they're even less comfortable, as it turns out, right? So One of the things that clearly comes out of this study is that if you give people more information, in particular about those resources that they are most likely to be surprised to see an application requiring, if you give them more information about the purpose for accessing that resource, they will be able to make better informed decisions, right? Which is not a surprise. In fact, you know, anyone who knows a little bit about privacy knows that one of the fundamental principles behind privacy is that you should state for what purpose you're collecting information. It's not just about collecting information in general. It's why do you need to collect this information? But in the app stores today, apps do not do that. They just tell you, at best, that they're requesting this permission, but they don't tell you why, which is very surprising. Okay, so once you start moving in this direction, the kinds of things that you can do is you can significantly simplify interfaces, such as Android permissions interfaces. So you can essentially move to interfaces, and this is not intended to be the final interface, but you can start moving towards interface that we say 95% of the people, so let's say brightest flashlight, right? You could say 95% of the users were surprised that this app sent your approximate location to the mobile ads, to mobile ads providers. Are you comfortable with that or not? Right? We could tell them 95% of people were surprised that this app also collected your phone's unique ID. Right? Here we could tell people that only 10% of people were surprised. So you could actually start flagging those few things that people are surprised about, right? And help people focus on that and not everything else. That's just creating more confusion. Right? So moving forward, the kinds of things that we're doing in this space is to try to further refine these types of interfaces based on recognition that not everyone feels the same way. So some people may actually be okay giving their location to brightest flashlight or to toss it, and other people may not. In fact, a lot of our prior work in this space has focused in particular on location sharing types of applications, where we've done a lot of work in understanding people's preferences. And one of the things that we've learned is that you can actually identify different groups of people, different personas. And so you could actually figure which persona best corresponds to a person. And then the interface that I showed you just a minute ago could now be customized to say, well, people who have a profile similar to you find it quite fine that brightest flashlight requires your location. Or people who've got a profile like you seem to be really surprised and very uncomfortable about that. And so that would make it even easier for you to actually make decisions. So those are the kinds of things that we're doing. Our long-term vision in this space, I don't have the time to discuss that, is in fact based on the development of what we call privacy assistants, personal privacy assistants. So those of you who know about Siri, for instance, on the iPhone, we're actually developing similar functionality for dealing with privacy. So this functionality uses machine learning over time to have dialogues with users and learn over time the user's preferences. And the idea, we're not there yet, but the idea is that this sort of functionality will essentially know so much about you over time, about what you feel comfortable with and what you don't, that when you download a new app, it might say, by the way, this app does this thing. I was wondering if you feel comfortable with it. Or it might say, you've downloaded this app, but did you realize that this app over the past week has shared your location 20 times with different advertisers? Are you comfortable with that or not? Those are the kinds of things that in the long term we're hoping to support. So I'm going to wrap up here. I realize it's potentially taking a bit longer than expected. So what I wanted to say, and to sort of briefly summarize this presentation this evening, so it's very clear that today one of the major challenges in this space is not technical in nature, but it's got a lot to do with the human element. People just do not appreciate all the vulnerabilities and all the threats that are associated with the use of smartphones. Right? And even though there are technologies that can mitigate some of these risks, just relying on these technologies will not cut it. We actually need to train users, and we need to provide users with interfaces that will empower them to also make better decisions. This issue is obviously exacerbated by bring-your-own-device types of trends, where increasingly all the risks associated with smartphones in the context of your private life extend also to corporate scenarios, where they're really creating a lot of potential, a lot of risk for companies. And this has to do also with the blurring between personal lives and work lives. So what I've tried to do is I've tried to sort of argue that obviously, yes, we need technologies to mitigate attacks, be it in the form of scanning software that will identify malware, being in the form of what people refer to as MDM, mobile device management software that will profile essentially your smartphone so that certain things are just beyond what you're allowed to do, forcing you to have long passwords and those kinds of things. But you also need to recognize there are limits to how far you can push this. And there are limits to how much this will protect you against some of the risks that we've talked about. You've got people who argue for partitions on a smartphone. For instance, we're going to have a partition for a corporation, a partition for personal use because no one wants to carry two phones. That just doesn't work. I mean, it's going to work only so far. In practice, all the mobile apps that you're going to have in your personal partition of the cell phone might still be tracking your location. You're going to be using them to access Facebook, to share your location with others. You're going to use Gmail. Before you know it, you might fall for a phishing attack that might impact essentially the security of that partition on your cell phone, and that will disclose a lot more information that a corporation would ever feel comfortable with. So there are really limits to these things. And ultimately, you're going to have to train people to essentially adopt safer practices to better appreciate the risks. And you're going to have to offer people much better interface than what's currently available. And so that's what I wanted to say. I hope this was interesting, and I'd be happy to take any questions that you might have.